I'm Mac Teeter, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to, at the outset, thank the board for inviting me here, allowing me to come and spend a weekend with you people and bring my wife. And we've had a great time, had an excellent host, guide, in Hal. And up till now, it's been great. Now I have to say my dues. I would like to thank those speakers who came before me. They've made my job very difficult, but did a great job for you people, and a great job for me sitting out there listening to them. I've been asked not to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway, because I want to thank you people in this area for sending to the Board of Trustees our friend David. Dave was on the board when I arrived and took me under his wing and was a great friend and did much for me. And he made a great contribution to Alcoholics Anonymous and is still doing so. And I think you people have a right to know that. And we think a great deal of Dave. And Dave, I know you don't like that, but accept the things you can't change. I don't usually talk much about the drinking part of my story, but I want you to know that I'm not here because I spent too much time in Sunday school. I started drinking when I was 15 years of age, and I too can remember the first drink I took. I too can remember the feeling that it gave me and what it did for me. Alcohol, for many years, didn't owe me anything. It did exactly for me what it was supposed to do. It made me equal. It made me able to do things that I was too shy to do. It made me comfortable. And for a long time, it worked for me. But as happened to all of us, it stopped doing what it was supposed to do and turned against me. And I can recall I graduated from high school and shortly after that went into the armed services and went overseas. And I'm proud of the record I have in the armed services. I was a good soldier. I liked it. And I liked the war. And as strange as it may seem, I was unhappy when the war ended, because I had become a commissioned officer in the Royal Canadian Artillery and had a good record with the fighting troops. And although there were many moments I didn't enjoy, I enjoyed what it did for me. It allowed me to be somebody. And I knew when that war was over that I was going to go back home and I was going to be a nothing again. Consequently, it took me a long time to get home. When I got home, my luggage had been there for many weeks, and they had a sign on the front of the house, "Welcome home, son," and it looked like it had been there for 2 years. I just kept missing the boat. I was in London, and every time I missed a draft for Canada, they'd tell me to go and leave again. And I'd go and leave and be a little late getting back and miss another draft. And I didn't think I was ever going to get home, and it really didn't matter. I was a very young man, and yet I stood in front of my commanding officer after the war was over and heard him say to me, "You will be court-martialed, and I don't know what you will use for your defense." And the charge was drunk on duty. Now, I had done nothing serious. I had been drunk, but an officer is supposed to be on duty 24 hours a day, and I'd been drinking very heavily. And he told me, if you drink as much in the next 8 years as you have in the last 8 days, you'll be no good to anybody, including yourself. And I thought, what a stuffy old guy. But when he talked about court-martial, I knew he meant business. And I could see a dishonorable discharge. I could see my gratuities going down the drain, all my benefits. I could see feel the shame that it would bring on my family. And I said to him, is it okay if I sit down? And he said, sure, go ahead. And I sat down, and he said to me, I don't know what you will use for your defense. And I said to him, I do. I'm going to plead chronic alcoholism. And I said, I drank with the doctor. He will be a witness. And he would have been, too. We had a medical officer we called Moe and a dental officer we called Doe. And Moe and Doe and I did a lot of drinking together. He said that might work. And then he got kindly and he said, supposing I don't court-martial you, what do you think I should do for you or do with you? I can still hear him when I said to him, I think maybe you could put me on the wagon for a couple of weeks. And he screamed at me, a couple of weeks, at the top of his voice. He said, you will be on the wagon indefinitely. You are not allowed to go into any place that sells liquor, into no other mess but your own, and you're not allowed to drink in your mess. Well, I walked out of there thinking, I got out of that deal pretty good. At that time, we didn't have any of the normal mix. We didn't have Cokes or 7-Up or anything. We had some kind of a raspberry drink that they made in Holland, and that's all we had for mix. Well, you couldn't tell what was in that. And I never missed a drink. I went right back in there and spoke to the bartender. I told him what to do, and he would hand me a glass of raspberry juice laced with cognac. I kept right on going. I remember when we left Holland, another chap and I, we went into the bar and we took all the part bottles of everything and emptied them into a gallon jug, a big crock, and we took that with us. We drank that on the way home down to the, from along the train. We're moving towards the coast. And I knew that there was something wrong with me then. I wasn't home very long until my grandfather took very sick and all of our relatives were called home. And I can remember in May of that year, sitting on the front steps of my grandmother's house, an uncle of mine who was a psychiatrist told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. This was in May of 1946. And he told me about this fellowship that had started and the idea of one drunk helping another and how great this was. And he, of course, had experience with patients. I found out later he was the man that brought the first big book into the city of Winnipeg and had been the person responsible for AA there. Well, I knew Brian was a very sincere guy, and I listened to the story and I thought it sounded pretty good, and I was glad he liked it. Many years later, I went to visit him and I said to him, do you remember the conversation we had sitting on the front steps at home? And he said, yes, I do. I said, did you have anything in mind for me? And he said, I certainly did. But you see, it didn't register then. It didn't make any sense. It was 10 years later before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was to drink another 10 years. In that 10 years, I married a girl that I'd gone to high school with 1 year, who lived next door to my grandmother, and who I'd loved all those years. And we had started going together when I came home from overseas, and 1947, we were married. I've been married to that lady for 32 years, and she stuck with me. So I didn't do everything wrong. She doesn't come with me very often, but when she does, I feel a little strange talking with her in the audience. But she's been pretty well behaved this weekend, and Hal and the doctor are coaching her. I'd like her to stand up so you can see who she is. You'll have something to say about that, I think. Well, as we progressed in the later years of my drinking, I used to sit in the beer parlor, and in those days, that's all we had, beer parlors. If you wanted hard liquor, you went to the liquor store and bought it. It wasn't allowed to be served, and I drank beer when there was nothing better to drink. And I drank with a young fellow named Cecil Corrigal. Cecil Corrigal was a very low-bottom, sloppy drunk. Then he got sober. I like to say we sent him ahead to find out what this is all about. And he was a very slow learner. It took him 4 years before he came back to tell us. But Cecil did run into a little difficulty with a guy in a card game, and he wound up in the hospital and got sober. And he used to come and visit me and tell me how good things were for him. And I resented him a great deal. I couldn't see why everybody was so good to him and no good drunk and so hard on me, the number one citizen in the town. I was having trouble with employment. I was having trouble with employers. I just had trouble holding a job. Last weekend, or 2 weekends ago, I was in Oregon. And a chap came to meet me at the airport in a beautiful new Cadillac. And later on, I found out he just completed building a beautiful new home. And on the way to the airport, when we were leaving, I said to him, "What business are you in?" He said, "I work for the post office." And I thought back to those last years of my drinking, when I was the best salesman in the world and unemployed, and nobody recognized my talents. My mother-in-law came to visit me, came to visit us. And during that visit, she suggested that maybe I should try and get a job in the post office. And she wounded me terribly to think that that was all she thought of me, that I was only good for delivering mail. And I thought of that a couple of weeks ago in Oregon, because I don't have a Cadillac, and I don't have a brand new home, but that postman does. And that mother-in-law might have been right all the time. A day came when I had quit drinking. I'd quit drinking many times, but this day, it was a particularly bad weekend. I got home on Saturday, I remember, and I remember that Norma had not bought any groceries because she didn't have any money, and things just weren't good. And I remember lying awake that night, determined that I would now just not drink until I got everything straightened out. I didn't promise myself I would never drink again. I promised myself that I would stop till I got things straightened out. I can remember the next morning, in as bad a shape I was, I remember the resolve I had, and I knew what I was going to do, and I got out on the street early, and I made a couple of sales calls, and I had a good enough job, although I hadn't produced very much, and I didn't know it, but I was on my way out of that job, too, at the time. I made a couple of quick calls, and then, all of a sudden, I thought to myself, maybe I shouldn't be too hasty about this thing. Maybe I shouldn't just cut it off all at once. Maybe I should have a few just to keep going And I remember walking into that beer parlor and having a beer. I remember the place being packed with people. I didn't find out till later that I was the only person in there. But it was full of people, and they were all screaming at me and all talking, and I stood up and shouted at them to quit yelling at me, to shut up and sit down, leave me alone. When I started doing that, I guess the guy behind the bar got a little nervous and asked me to leave, and I left. I went and bought 3 bottles of rye whiskey and checked into the hotel. I can remember parts of that afternoon. I can remember crying and sobbing and feeling so sorry for myself and wondering where it was all going to end and what was I going to do. And then I got an idea that I'd phone Cecil. And I phoned Cecil, and he was busy. He couldn't come to the phone. So I asked for his boss, who happened to be a good friend of mine. And I could remember being at a party one night when, due to a series of circumstances, I said I had no friends. And I could remember Alec turning to me and saying, "Mac, you got one friend, because I'm your friend." And I said to Alec on the phone, "Are you still my friend?" And he said, "I sure am." I said, "Come and see me. I'm in desperate trouble." He had just left a group of people, and they were planning a farewell party for me, for my wife and I, because I was supposed to move out of that city. So Alec came, and he took one look at me and got on the phone and got a hold of Cease and said, "Stop whatever you're doing. It doesn't matter. Get over here." Cease came over and apparently phoned Norma and said he had me and what should he do with me, and she said, "Bring him home." I don't remember much about that. I remember going back to the hotel a couple days later to pick up my rubbers. And the guy behind the desk said, you and Cease were on quite a party a few days ago. And he said, "You weren't in too bad shape, but Cease was sure in bad shape." I think he had us mixed up. Cease had been sober for 4 years then. Well, they took me home, and that whole deal started. She stayed with me for a long time. And when he went, somebody else came. I remember they were coming and going, and I remember Elmer coming. And I was trying to eat some poached eggs, and I was sitting in the living room, and I wasn't dressed. I was in my pajamas and house coat, and I remember this guy coming in and sitting there and making such great statements. And he looked at me and said, "Are you feeling a little sick?" And I thought, man, this guy is really something. And somehow they told me that I should make a list of all the debts I had. I don't know how that got started, because that was bad business. But they knew I had financial difficulty, and I remember thinking, if I write all this down, Norma will walk right out the door. I remember writing down all my debts and showing them to her, and she looked at it and said, "That's quite a bit of money we owe." And it was then. It's not so much in today's terms, but it was a lot of money then. And I had collection agencies phoning me, and I still don't like collection agencies. If there's one little bit of resentment left in me, it has to be for them. You know, they phone you early in the morning, collect, long distance from some other city, and you haven't got a job, and you haven't got any money, and you got nothing but creditors, and they're going to make trouble for you. And they phone you at your expense. I can remember saying, "If you don't get off the telephone, they'll come and take it out." So I didn't arrive here because things were good. And after I got here, our home was sold so that we could pay off some financial obligations and make another start. And we moved to another city, and my sister and my uncle came up, and And they took our two children to stay with my sister. We had a little girl, a little boy. And I remember the day they drove away, because I knew they would never come back. I can remember the desolation I felt and the total defeat, because there was no way that I could have any hope. But Norma stayed, and we moved to another city, and we got a, what we used to call a suite, an apartment. It was a room in a basement of an old house. And it had kind of a little division, so you really could call it two rooms. It was air-conditioned. You could look right out past the gas pipe and see the sun. I remember we had a torrential rain, and the basement flooded, and all everything we had in there was floating around the water. I was a traveling salesman. I used to go away on the road on Mondays. Norma lived there. She got a job. She hadn't worked from the time she was pregnant with her daughter until after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the sole breadwinner in the family. And there wasn't much bread a lot of times. She went back to work, and we started to pay our debts off. And I tried to put deals together with people so that we could get our children back. I tried to plan to rent a home and get a couple of people to live in one room and a couple in another, and between a bunch of us, we could get enough rent that we'd have a home, we'd get our children back, and it never worked out that way. I went to meetings, and I stayed sober. I'm one of those fortunate people. I never had to take another drink from the time Cecil came to see me in that old hotel. One day, one Saturday afternoon, the phone rang. And a voice said, "I understand you're looking for a house." And I said, "How much is the rent?" He said, "Doesn't make any difference." I said, "It makes a great deal of difference. How much is the rent?" At that time, I was paying $46 a month for everything. And he said, "Well, come and see the place and see if you like it, and then we'll talk about the rent." And I guess we had nothing else to do anyway. We went over and had a look at it, and we sat down after we looked at it, and I knew there was no way we could afford this place. Just no way. And he said to me, "I tell you what you do. I've got two, a boy and a girl. The girl was working, and the boy is still in high school." And he said, we have this house, and we had it rented to two people, and they moved out and left us with it. And if you'll supply the groceries, we'll supply the house." And I can remember saying to Mike, "Would you put that in writing?" See, there had to be something wrong with this deal. It was too good a deal. And then he said, "How long have you been sober?" And I told him, and he said, "I've been sober 2 years." He belonged to an Alcoholics Anonymous group out in the country. The next day we moved in. And a few months later, our children came back. And we started from there. I remember my mother-in-law came up to visit us, and she offered to put the down payment on a home. And we accepted that offer, and I was in Alcoholics Anonymous a little over 2 years. We had our own home in 1958. And we didn't have any relatives around us. Our relatives all lived in Manitoba, and at that time we were in Saskatchewan. And we had a house full of drunks most of the time. It was great in those days. People would just drop in, and, you know, if I went out to cut the lawn, I could be guaranteed I wouldn't have to do much because somebody would interrupt me. And we'd have to have a cup of coffee and talk. And I can remember our kids. You know, if you weren't Alcoholics Anonymous, you were a nothing. They wouldn't sit around and listen, but if it was somebody in AA, they'd sit around and they got to know everybody. And We had great times. Our group used to have Christmas parties. We'd have parties for the kids. We'd have picnics in the summer. And there was a real closeness, I think, that we don't have today. At least not where I live. And it was great, and things went good. I didn't lose a job. I'd never had to look for a job since I came here. The day came when we knew making a living was not a problem. It was a question of what I wanted to do. And at that time, I moved into the business I'm in now in broadcasting. And we moved to the city of Regina. A few years later, we moved to where we are now in Winnipeg. I'm telling you this because I want you to know that you don't start at the top. You don't start at the top, but if you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous and do things you're supposed to do, things will happen beyond your control, beyond your dreams. There was nothing that I did that made it happen. It just happened. There might be people sitting here tonight that are wondering if they really belong with this outfit. You might be new and you might be wondering if you're really alcoholic or not. I don't think you're unique. Most of us who are here wondered if we were bad enough to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I certainly knew I wasn't. I just came here to get things straightened out. And I can remember the doubts I had for so long. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous about 6 months before I really realized that I was an alcoholic. Of course, I didn't know what an alcoholic was when I came here. I, too, came from a good Christian home. I like what Joe Lee says about that. He said, good Christian homes are just a breeding ground for alcoholics. Everybody says they came from a good Christian home. Well, when I was a little boy, I lived with my grandmother a great deal, and I can remember being sick. I used to have a lot of earaches, and I had tonsil trouble and adenoid problems, and I could stay home from school. I wasn't sick in a sense that I couldn't eat anything, but I could stay in bed and they'd bring my meals up to me and mother me and read to me all day, and it was just great. Later on in life, I used to think to myself when things were rough, if I could only be sick again, if I could be sick and have somebody look after me, how nice that would be. And then I came in the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing they told me was I was sick. You told me you're a sick man. Did that ever sound good? And for a long time, I wanted to stay sick. I wanted to dwell in the illness. And I'm afraid a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous want to dwell in the illness. It takes courage to get well. But you know, we are living in a world that is in the epidemic stages of alcoholism. Not just in North America, everywhere you look. There will be more people die in North America from alcoholism in the next 12 months than from any other single illness. We got some strange things going on. In our country, we have 400 to 500 programs dealing with alcoholism. A few years ago, we gave a professor in university $150,000 to investigate these programs. I think he took off. We've never heard him more. I phoned him to see if I could help him, just for a piece of the action, but he said he would send me a report, and I haven't got one. And we have in Alcoholics Anonymous a means of recovery from alcoholism. We were not given a legacy of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Behind me is a sign, our insignia that says recovery. It does not say sobriety on the bottom of that triangle. And so I believe that we can recover from alcoholism because our book tells us that. Now, I know what people mean when they say they're recovering, and I know that we will never be... Well, nobody hurt me as much as I hurt myself. So, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out I had an incurable, hopeless illness. I had an illness that was a killing illness, and that it was incurable. I could not be cured. But I could recover through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not have to stay sick. And for those of you who would care to disagree with that, be my guest. I give you the right to your opinion, only ask you to give me the right to mine, and I reserve the right to change mine anytime I want to. But you see, the book always gives us an out, too, because it says those who do not recover are men or women who cannot give themselves completely to this simple program. So take your pick. Personally, I like to say I've recovered. I haven't had a drink for over 23 years. I don't think I'm going to get any drier. I try to practice this program the best of my ability, and if I'm miserable, I don't think I can blame it on alcoholism. If I'm doing something wrong, I can no longer say, well, don't criticize me, I'm a poor, sick alcoholic. If I'm a bum, I'm just a bum. So we have to, sooner or later, accept the responsibility of being well. And we have to give up all our alibis and stand up on our 2 feet and say, I just like being well. There is nothing wrong with being a well human being. And I am a well human being, and I like to stand up here and tell you that, and I enjoy it. I like being well. I don't want to be sick again. And that all came about through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I accepted, first of all, the fact of my illness. And I accepted that I was everything that an alcoholic could be. You know, I used to say to myself, I never went to jail. Well, when you start to think about it, going to jail wasn't a good thing to do if you wanted to drink. And you don't find a lot of smart people in jail. You go check them out. They did some pretty dumb things to get there. I never spent much time in a hospital. I lied about that. Part of the reason I was late getting home from overseas is I was in a hospital. I was in there as a direct result of drinking. Trying to get well enough to come home. And you know, when Cease came to see me, he brought a list of 20 questions and asked me to answer these questions so I could qualify myself. And one of those questions said, did you seek lower companions when you drank? And I knew he knew I drank with him. And I also knew he hadn't got a real good one yet. He had been 4 years stumbling around, and so I had to say I was one. But I didn't really believe it until I got around here for a while. And I had to learn to accept my illness, and I had to learn to accept my alcoholism. That just doesn't happen automatically. You see,
I never became an alcoholic until I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. The day before, if you had asked me if I was an alcoholic, I'd have told you no, I'm a social drinker. Now, we hear some genius in New York is going to make social drinkers out of alcoholics. I want you to know that social drinking damn near killed me. And I became an alcoholic and haven't had a drink since. And if you don't believe me, go check all the bars. Go in there and say, everybody that's an alcoholic, stand up. You won't find any alcoholics drinking. They're all social drinkers. Alcoholics are sitting in places like this in an absolute abnormal state of sobriety. It is not easy to accept the illness alcoholism. It's not easy to say to yourself, I am one of those, regardless of what those happen to be. It's not easy to say I'm the same kind of a person that would wind up in jail. But for the grace of God, I didn't go to jail. It's not easy to accept the fact that I'm the kind of a person that would be in a mental institution. But for the grace of God, I didn't go to a mental institution. Learning to accept that fatality of alcoholism is not an easy thing. And if you're having trouble with it, that's just because it's a troubled thing. It's hard to recognize and accept. Nobody wants to be an alcoholic. We denied our alcoholism until we couldn't deny it anymore and we had no place else to go. And I have spent many times working with alcoholics who have gone back drinking. I'm one of those fortunate people that belong to a group of slippers. The group I belong to is called the Golden Slippers. And it was started because I got a phone call one night from a guy, actually it was from a girl that I sponsored, and she told me that her father would like to talk to me, but he always thought I was too busy and didn't want to bother me, and she asked me if I would call him. And I did. I called old Ross, and we went and had coffee together, and he told me that if I would just work with him the way I worked with other people, he could stay sober, but nobody was paying any attention to him. And you know, that happens. You get a guy that comes to a group, and he's drunk one week and sober the next, and pretty soon it doesn't matter what he says. You know he's going to get drunk again anyway. And maybe if you're asking people to say something as an afterthought, you'll say, well, Ross, what do you got to say tonight? And before he says it, everybody has dismissed anything he's going to say anyway. And we're getting to close the meeting. And that happens at Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, old Ross, he never stopped drinking. But the next night, I got a phone call from Cliff. And Cliff was an interesting drunk. He had been around for a long time, and Cliff always committed suicide when he was drinking. And he did it with a shotgun, an automatic Browning. And Cliff would be sitting there killing himself with his shotgun, and you never were quite sure where it was pointing. And the first thing he had to do was say, Cliff, give me the shotgun. And then you'd pump the shells out of it and stand it up in the corner and take old Cliff to the hospital, and the next day he'd check himself out and go back to his trailer with his shotgun. Well, Cliff phoned me and he said, Mac, I hate to bother you, but I phoned everybody else I know and nobody will come to see me. And I really need help. So I phoned old Ross and said, Ross, come on, we're going 12-step call. We're going to see Cliff. And I didn't know for some time, but old Ross drank some of Cliff's liquor that night. Now, these two guys were drinking, and I was sober. And they arranged with me to have an early breakfast the next morning. And I was perfectly sane. I went right along with it. At my expense, we had breakfast. And they told me about how they were special, and Nobody paid any attention to him. They wanted some special treatment. I remember went for a long walk, and Cliff kept saying, "Can't we go back now?" Because he had some booze stashed in his car. But we decided to have a special meeting. And then they said, "Oh, well, if we have a meeting, everybody will come, and pretty soon they'll be paying attention to us again." And I said, "Well, have the meeting when it's inconvenient for people to come." Well, that group's been meeting Sunday morning ever since. We meet at 8:30 Sunday morning. And that's not bad. That's a compromise. They wanted to start at 7. Well, old Cliff, he came to Blue Ridge with me. And he's never had a drink since he left Blue Ridge. He's got 2 or 3 years sobriety. And old Ross, he's got about 6 months left. And they're the most sober-looking guys you ever saw. Ross was our secondary when we formed the group, and he was still drinking, the best secondary we ever had. And then he got sober, and he wasn't worth a damn after that. We just made him a group historian because he kept those records so neat in the early days, and nobody's done that since. I remember his wife phoned me up and said, "What are you doing letting Ross handle the money?" I said, "Well, if he's drinking, I can't think of anybody that needs the money worse than he does. And if he spends it, we'll get it back sometime." I don't know whether he ever spent it or not, but we've always never had a money problem. And that group is 50, 60 people meeting there Sunday morning now, and we spend a lot of money on birthday cakes. So you see, I know what it is to work with people that slip. And I know what it is to get pious in sobriety. I know what it's like to sit there and say they know where to go. I know that I have gone on 12-step calls, and I've gone to a great deal of trouble to help a total stranger and turn down a guy that was in my own group. Said, "You know where to go." Well, I don't do that anymore. And please don't do that. You know, just because a guy gets drunk, all he's doing is doing what he's supposed to do. Alcoholics are not supposed to be sober. And when life gets too much for an alcoholic and he hasn't got anything else going for him, he's going to get drunk because he's got no place else to go. And it doesn't say that we should carry the message to somebody that's brand new and never heard it before. And so we got a group of golden slippers. We put on a little shindig in January up there. That's another thing you should not ever do, is put on a conference in Canada in January, because it snows and it's 50 below. But we've had some of your people up there, and they had a good time. And we get 1,100 to 1,300 people show up there in January just to have a weekend. And it's something else. And that's all run by the golden slippers. I can remember pointing people, saying, "Look at the guy that's handling the money. He just got out of a drunk tank 2 weeks ago. And he's the treasurer of this thing." And they do a good job. Accepting the illness, alcoholism, is a difficult thing. We can rationalize. We can do things with our mind. You see, every day I am told in that book to ask God to direct my thinking. And I do that, because I don't trust my own thinking. An alcoholic is a person who has a mind and a body that is different from normal, and it will always be that way. We can see things different than most people. We can rationalize, we can excuse ourselves, and we can make sense out of things that are totally insensible. I sponsored a little girl that had a bad habit of setting fires. And I remember I said to her one day, "What is the worst thing you ever did?" And she said, "I set fire to an apartment block." And I said, "Why did you do that?" She said, "I don't really know." And then I said, "But I bet it made sense to you at the time." And she said, "Yes, I know it did. I had a legitimate reason to do that." Her boyfriend got her mad one day, and he was working in a new pizza parlor, and she went down there and set 2 fires in that place. She's sober today. She hasn't set fires for a long time. But you see, an alcoholic can think things and make sense out of it. It makes sense to you when you walk in the front door and your wife is mad and you say, "What the hell are you mad at? I told you last Tuesday I was going to be late." That makes sense. It makes sense to sit in a bar and say, "Let's have one more." It makes sense to go into a bar to have one drink and stay 2 weeks. That makes sense when you're doing it. An alcoholic can make sense out of things that are not sensible. And my mind is still that way. And I don't trust my thinking. I ask God to direct my thinking. That's why I have to do that every morning. Another thing I'd like you to know, an alcoholic means it when he makes promises. But something happens. And I know this has happened to people that I've been sponsoring. I sponsored a doctor that was 23 years in Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't have one sober year. And he kept coming back and he kept reading the book. And he is sober today, working in an alcoholism foundation. And when I was talking to him and I was trying to explain to him how he rationalized, I remember saying to him, "You have above average intelligence you have to be where you are. You obviously have above average education. You tell me how your mind can work and you can rationalize that after all these years it's going to be different. That this time you're only going to have one drink." And I remember him saying to me, "Mac, if that happened to me, I wouldn't mind it. I wouldn't mind it half as much as what really happens to me." Because he said, "I'm the kind of a guy that can pick up a drink and drink it with no thought whatsoever." So if some alcoholic that you're working with picks up a drink and drinks it, don't say, "I wonder what happened to him." Hell, he's just an alcoholic. An alcoholic sometimes drinks booze. And we forget that. And if I want to ask God to direct my thinking, I have to come to some understanding of a power greater than myself. And that is a very difficult thing to do, too. I never denied the existence of God in my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found out that alcoholics have trouble with God. And if I was going to be an alcoholic, I was going to have trouble with God. And I did have. Let me tell you what it says in the book. It says, God either is or he isn't. Now, I don't know what kind of an intellectual alcoholic you were, but I sure as hell didn't talk about isn't. I discussed international affairs. I didn't even bother worrying about little municipal things or just national things, international. I drank with intellectuals and we didn't talk about isn't. God either is or he isn't. That's not too hard. And then it says, he's either everything or he's nothing. How can you talk about nothing? Maybe normal people can. You know, when it said we're different, it didn't say we're inferior. You can't talk about a nothing. You can't even think about a nothing. If you want to know where God is, look around you. He's everything. He's everything there is. And if you have spent the time here this weekend that I have spent and have to wonder about that, you've got a real serious problem. They'll be picking you up someday. Because it's here. You don't have to look anywhere. I remember an old-timer saying to me, "You're not going anywhere. You're already here. This is where it's at." I came to believe in the God of my understanding. I put that question away, and I've never had to worry about it. I never have to worry about whether I'm an alcoholic or whether there's a God or not. And I have done that because I don't trust myself. I am not the kind of a person that can get up in the morning and say, "I wonder if I'm alcoholic today or not. Well, what should I be today, alcoholic or non-alcoholic? Sure as hell, I'd make the wrong decision." And I cannot get up and say, "I wonder if there's a God or not today. I wonder if I have to go back to relying on myself." I can't do that. Maybe somebody can. People tell me they can take those steps every day. I can't do that. I have to come to grips with these things and get them settled in my mind, and that's it. And that's the way it's going to be for me. I know there's a God. There has to be, or I wouldn't be here. I can't live without that. I didn't come here to get good. I really didn't come here to get sober. I came here, and I'm still here because I want to stay alive. I want to live and be comfortable and have peace of mind and contentment and happiness. Now, supposing it's all wrong. Supposing we get to the other end of the line and the game's over and we find out that this has all been a joke, that we've been led down the garden path, that there is no God. And you look back on 25 years of peace of mind and contentment and happiness, hell, you could have been puking all that time. We sure take a chance when we say we believe in a God. You see, you can't lose. You can't lose. You can't do him wrong. There's no way you can do anything wrong in this program. If you do a step and you say, "I wonder if I did it right," you can't do it wrong. If you do it the best of your ability, it's done. That's the way it's done. And if you have to do it over again, you don't get any bad marks for that. I'd like to tell you that since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, everything's gone good for me. It hasn't. Life doesn't protect us just because we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you about our family and how we grew up, and I can remember when my daughter was married, she said, "No matter where I live, I'm going to be home for Christmas." We had a closeness that was incredible. We still have. But some of you know, and I've mentioned this before when I've been down this country, that I stood in a doctor's office one day and heard him say that our son had cancer. And my life turned a corner. And so did my wife. And so did all of our family. Well, we lost that battle in December of 1974, just before Christmas. Our son was taken away. And we had to start and put things together again. 2 years later, our daughter came over for dinner one night, and I didn't sense anything wrong. We went into the living room and have our coffee, and my wife said to me, "I've got something to tell you. I have cancer." And she said, "The toughest part is telling you." Well, she had an operation, and by the grace of God, she's with me here this weekend. But you see, you don't grow walking on level ground. You grow walking uphill. I watched their son turn from a boy to a man. Instead of me teaching him how to live, he taught me how to die. After the funeral, my wife gave me a Christmas present that he had for me. It was a medallion to go around my neck, and I don't wear it, I leave it in a safe place. On one side of that medallion was the word Dad, and on the other side were the words, thanks for being here. A boy who was dying did that for his father, who was a drunk. Some people asked me if I thought of taking a drink. I was never so thankful for Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. Nobody could be that thankful. It never occurred to me to take a drink. Because, you see, in the 10th step of my program, that problem had been removed. And that program worked. And every problem that is put in your path, you get the strength to meet it. And some days they're big problems. Some days you can identify with a man that says, this time you gave me a mountain. But you get the strength to meet it. And let me close by telling you a little story about a man who was walking with his God on a beach. And as he walked down the beach, before him flashed his life. And sometimes there were good times, and sometimes there were bad times. And as he looked back, he could see two sets of footprints. But then he noticed when the bad times of his life flashed before him, there was only one set of footprints. And he said to his God, you promised me you would stay with me through good times and bad times. How come you leave me when times are bad? And his God answered him, and he said, son, I did not leave you. You see, when times were bad, I had to pick you up and carry you. And those footprints you see behind you are my prints. Thank you very much.